Welcome to Financial Repression Authority's Roundtable Insight, where the best fund managers, economists, and industry leaders discuss the key investment issues and challenges in the current macroeconomic environment.
Hi, welcome to FRA's Roundtable Insight. This is Richard Benulli. Today we have Charles Hugh Smith. He's the author of 9 books on our economy and society, including A Radically Beneficial World, Automation, Technology, and Creating Jobs for All, Resistance, Revolution, Liberation, A Model for Positive Change, and The Nearly Free University in the Emerging Economy. His blog of twominds.com has logged over 55 million page views and is number 7 on CNBC's top alternative finance sites. He's an author and a leading global finance blogger and America's philosopher, we call him. Welcome, Charles.
Thank you, Richard. I'm always a little embarrassed by that high praise, but we just try to get clarity on the major issues that we're dealing with.
Yeah, and I thought today we'd focus on the big volatility that's happening, or the return of volatility in the financial markets, how and why that has happened, what's been happening over the last few years in terms of overvaluations, asset prices versus GDP. You've been gracious to provide a number of charts, which we'll make available on the website as well. And where would you like to begin on those charts?
Well, Richard, I think let's start with what you mentioned, like the overstretched valuations of risk assets, and which have now expanded to include not just stocks, but actually bonds and real estate. Everything's now a risk asset. And how really underneath the surface of this bull market and the low volatility that until recently was the norm, the asset valuations have disconnected from the real economy. And I'll just kind of go through these few charts and kind of talk to that story. That if we look at asset prices versus GDP, which is what, you know, one measure of the real world economy, right? The production of goods and services. We see that we are now in a more extreme bubble than we were even in the dot-com or the housing bubble, the two previous bubbles, in terms of the valuation difference between rather modest GDP growth and the enormous growth of asset valuations. So, and then I have a chart here that shows one of the many central bank balance sheets. This happens to be the Bank of Japan balance sheet, and we see that it's just rocketed. It's tripled in just a few years. As the central banks have created money out of thin air and used it to buy assets to prop up asset valuations. And meanwhile, and then we also have a chart here of the S&P 500 from showing how it's done nothing but move higher with a few minor blips from 2009. And my little note here is, hey, I'm a genius, meaning that anybody that went long in 2009 and bet on the central banks providing support, you know, basically the so-called Bernanke put or the Yellen put, not allowing the markets to decline, mm-hmm. then it makes you feel like a genius, right? Just buy the dip, and you've been rewarded.
No brainer.
Yeah. And then there's a chart here of the VXX, which is one of the volatility indexes, short-term volatility futures. Mm-hmm. And it doesn't show the spike in the last month that's really changed this picture. But my point in posting this was you can see nothing but a steady decline in volatility for 2 straight years. Now, this is just not natural. Yeah. And this is not the way unfettered markets respond, right? There's volatility as part of the market structure because it's based on human emotions and changing circumstances. Meanwhile, back in the real economy, we have 2 charts here. One is corporate profits, which have been stagnating arguably since 2013, but certainly since 2014. So how can the markets be soaring when corporate profits are stagnating? And of course, it's margin expansion and is the psychology of euphoria and so on and so forth. But the bottom line, it's the asset valuations are getting more and more disconnected from the real economy.
Yeah.
And the other chart here I have of the real economy is labor's share of the economy, of GDP. And we can see that it's stair-stepping down over the last 20 years, that every time there's an asset bubble, then it sort of stabilizes. And then when that asset bubble pops, then labor share declines. So the story here is everybody working for a wage or a salary, their share of the economy is declining steadily. And so that's not good. In other words, that's not good for wage earners, just as stagnating corporate profits is not good for the overall economy. And yet asset prices continue higher. So clearly, we're disconnected from the real economy, and we're also seeing financial repression being aimed at volatility specifically.
Yeah, so as the whole movement from the financial crisis 2009 progressed, the involvement by central banks in doing quantitative easing programs has resulted in this reduced volatility as they have repressed the interest rates and bond yields. It's become a very low volatile environment, increasingly so.
Right, and a lot of us feel that volatility is now seen by central banks as a signaling device. In other words, they're signaling to us that all is well, that the economy is stable and growing, because volatility is low. Now, of course, it's clear that they've been intervening specifically to reduce volatility, and that program was visible in these charts. In other words, volatility has been declining for two straight years, and so now that volatility repression seems to have been broken by this tremendous spike in the VIX and the VXX, and the crushing of the short volatility XIV and those instruments. And so we wonder, or we're pressed to ask, what's changed? And of course, what's changed is the central banks are now talking about withdrawing some of their quantitative easing, with, you know, reducing their bond purchases or even reducing their balance sheets and raising interest rates. And that's created a tremendous uncertainty in the participants' minds. Like, will the central banks like restart QE and buy the dip, or are they going to let the markets actually revert to a more authentic price discovery? And that's scaring a lot of people and creating uncertainty.
Yeah, exactly. We recently did a podcast with Chris Whalen on his article with regard to bank earnings and volatility. He points out from his perspective, he sees as the Federal Reserve ends its reinvestment of cash when bonds redeem, you know, as those bonds mature out, the volatility will return to the markets and spreads will widen. So that's his view. We had a podcast on this about a week or two before all the volatility began, so it was quite precocious on the part of Chris for that observation.
Yeah, and that's a really critical dynamic that you and Chris discussed, because after 9 years of financial repression, which has led to, you know, asset valuations rising steadily, we're now at the point where virtually anybody, even a conventional economist, understands that we're kind of at the end of the normal business cycle. In other words, we're due for a business cycle recession, which is basically a reduction in the rate of growth of borrowing, right? In other words, the standard business cycle is as animal spirits rise and people start borrowing more money, they start investing more. They pursue speculative investments, and that grows the economy, and the borrowing has a positive effect on GDP and productivity. But at the end of the cycle, people start speculating in very marginal projects, and marginal borrowers get into the game and start speculating with money that they really can't afford to borrow. And so then the marginal borrowers default, and the marginal projects go bust, and then there's a retrenching of credit. And that's a feature of capitalism you can't really get rid of. Mm-hmm. And so clearly the central banks are nervous because if they don't let interest rates rise during this last period of growth, and if they don't reduce their balance sheets, then what kind of ammunition are they going to have to deal with the next recession? And so that's setting up a lot of uncertainty because the banks obviously feel pressure to start normalizing, if you will, interest rates and their balance sheets. Because if they don't, then, you know, how can they drop interest rates and how can they increase their asset purchases if they've already if they've never retrenched at all?
And you recently had a blog posting entitled "The End of Artificial Stability," in which you you explained this how it's happening and how you see the entitlement ending, the entitlement of market participants becoming accustomed to an implicit entitlement. Can you elaborate on that?
Yeah, I thank you very much for that question, Richard, because I think it's one of those things that we take for granted, and so we're not really aware of it. But by financial repression and reducing volatility through intervention and boosting asset valuations, the central banks have created an entitlement for capital that's not shared by labor. In other words, we see labor's share of GDP declining, and we see capital getting rewarded with 10 to 15 to 20% gains annually in stocks and healthy gains in bonds and real estate. And so this has now become the foundation of price discovery. It's not whether the asset is yielding a high return. It's the whole price discovery is now based on our central banks supporting this asset class. And so that's a really artificial form of price discovery, and part of that plays out as an entitlement for capital. In other words, capital expects as an entitlement to earn 10 to 15% because of central bank intervention. But that's really artificial. In other words, in a real market economy, capital is at risk, and some of the capital invested in marginal returns or marginal investments is going to suffer losses, and there's going to be volatility as that marginality is discovered, right? And so all of that has been repressed, and now as it comes back, then the market's not accustomed anymore to actual volatility and the hedging that's required to moderate volatility. It's like hedging's disappeared too, because as long as the central banks were supporting the market and buying the dip, then you didn't even need hedging. Why throw money away on hedges?
Yeah, and speaking of hedges, in terms of risk transference, you had another blog posting entitled "What Just Changed," in which you discuss the aspect of risk increasing in the system. That it doesn't disappear, it sort of goes, you know, within the system, and this overall risk has been increasing. Can you elaborate on that?
Well, that's thank you for that question too, Richard. You know, I would start with a market that's extremely volatile, cryptocurrencies, right? And a lot of people look at this with dismay, like, wow, you know, I mean, I can't. It's phenomenal the tremendous volatility in cryptocurrencies, but they're volatile precisely because there's no central authority repressing that volatility, and so you get these huge $2,000 moves in Bitcoin in a few days, or the equivalent in the other cryptocurrencies. But this is because it's an unfettered market. And so therefore it's fully exposed to the tides of human emotion and the news flow. And that's part of the evidence that it is an unfettered market, is that it has a lot of volatility. And so when you repress volatility, you can create the appearance or the illusion that risk has vanished, right? But actually risk can't really be, disappeared, if you will. It can't be made to go away. It can be hedged, but if it simply flows into the system itself. So in other words, central banks are playing this game of increasing their balance sheets to buy assets, to boost asset prices, to create the wealth effect, which then generates more credit, more borrowing, and more spending, and then that's going to grow the economy. But that story really is about risk being offloaded from borrowers and investors onto the central bank's balance sheet itself, right? In other words, that risk is being buried into the central banks, but it doesn't mean the risk has gone away. It's simply been transferred into the system itself. And so I know this is not a very intuitive topic, but if we look at the economy or the financial system as a whole, we can see what happens when risk becomes systemic. And that's what happened in 2008, right? The risk was supposed to be limited to subprime mortgages, which was a relatively small part of the total global financial system. But a lot of the risk in those years from 2002 to 2007 was actually flowing into the financial system as a whole. And that's why it broke in 2008. The risk was not limited to subprime mortgages. It had leaked into the entire system.
And so where do we go from here? How do you see interest rates playing out and the effects on the financial markets?
Well, that is the trillion-dollar question. Okay. And I don't know if I have any profound insight, but I think that central banks are under pressure to normalize, right? Because, as I said, for two reasons. One is the one I mentioned earlier, that they need to normalize so they have some ammunition. They have some ability to lower interest rates again and pursue quantitative easing in the next recession. But the other pressure that we've spoken to in previous shows, maybe not quite so explicitly, is there is now political pressure on the central banks because their policy of financial repression and boosting asset valuations has exacerbated wealth and income inequality. And this is now being recognized as a reality. And so the central banks are under political pressure to stop rewarding owners of capital to the exclusion, really, of wage earners, right? It's the people who had wealth have been further enriched by the central bank policies. So that's another reason why they really need to normalize. In other words, let the market start pricing yields and interest rates. And also reduce their support of asset valuations. And so this creates a volatility in the sense that we can no longer count on central banks being able to guarantee higher asset prices every month. So where do you put your money? What kind of strategy do you use if you can't count on that central bank policy of buying every dip and always pushing asset prices higher? Then you actually have to analyze risk, and you actually have to have an investment strategy that deals with creating value. And I think a lot of people have simply lost those skill sets.
Yeah. And And what would happen if, as interest rates go higher, if the U.S. dollar were to get stronger, do you think that would have an effect on the some $9 trillion in U.S. dollar denominated debt in emerging markets, which could then have an effect of international capital flows coming back to the U.S.? Do you see that potential scenario?
You know, Richard, you just described a dynamic that I see as inevitable, but most people seem to be missing it because, you know, it's a dollar negative kind of atmosphere. People think that the dollar is going to continue declining because of U.S. Deficits, and all of which are real. But I think you're absolutely right. That $9 to $10 trillion dollars in outstanding dollar denominated debt has to be serviced with dollars. And, you know, in terms of who's on one side of the boat, it's the short, the dollar trade is the heavier side of the boat at this point. So the pain trade would be for the dollar to rise. And so I think you're absolutely right. People seem to have forgotten about that $9 to $10 trillion in dollar denominated debt. And that really overwhelms the amount of debt, international debt, in other words, offshore debt in other currencies. So there may be a lot of debt, you know, based in China that's domestic, and in other words, they borrow renminbi, yuan in China. But I don't think there's anything close to that sum in offshore, you know, yuan. Like, in other words, debt denominated in RMB. That's a trivial sum. So, yeah, we're going to see some capital flows that are going to reverse the current sentiment, I think, which is against the dollar.
Mm-hmm. And you've also written recently about the ghosts of 1968. So could this be a similar time? And also with the financial markets, could we get a sort of 1968 to 1982 phenomenon where stock prices don't really go anywhere much, but on the social front, do you what analogy and similarities do you see with 1968 arising from trends in the economy?
That's a great topic, Richard, and thank you for bringing it up because you know, the Italian election is in a few days, and it's just one example of many in which the status quo seems to be fearful of populism, which is fundamentally a reaction of protest or dissent to the wealth, the rising wealth and income insecurity and inequality that's characterized the last 10 years. And so we see populism rising, which is a corollary or kind of an echo, if you will, of the social and political turmoil of the late 1960s. And I think maybe the difference is there was a lot of abundance in the 1960s. In other words, economies were growing rapidly. And the disenfranchised and marginalized populace wanted a piece of that prosperity, and a lot of that, a lot of the drivers of the social turmoil of the late 60s was the sense that the many wanted the same benefits that were accruing to the few, and now we're in an era where there seems to be a reduction in actual abundance of jobs, of high wage, you know, of employment and so on. And so I think the populism is now a response to a sense that there's the pie is shrinking, and as the pie shrinks, there's the few seem to be benefiting at the expense of the many, and that's what's driving populism globally. And so I think that that's also a huge dynamic that's going to impact financial markets, because there, what may be financially possible may not be politically possible.
And so you see that this trend in a lot of places, Europe, the U.S., North America, happening?
Right. And And to some, like, more perhaps suppressed degree, even in Asia, you know, that that even in China with a command economy, the central authorities are feeling the pressure to respond to wealth inequality in China and to try to expand opportunities in the impoverished West. And so even in command economies, we see these same sort of pressures for populism and a change in the status quo socially and politically. And so that does seem to me to echo the late 1960s, that we could see a lot more social discord and a lot more social disruption as the dissatisfaction of the many who have been left out of a lot of the prosperity of the last 10 years finds political expression and manifestation.
Well, great insight from Charles today on this. And how can our listeners learn more about your work, Charles?
Please visit me at oftwominds.com, and you can get a download a free the first 35 pages of my most recent book, Money and Work Unchained. And there's a lot of other free stuff on my site as well.
Okay, great. Thank you, Charles.
Thank you, Richard. Really appreciate the opportunity.
The FRA Roundtable Insight Show is for informational and educational purposes only and should not be considered as a solicitation or offer to purchase or sell any securities. The investments, investment strategies, and investment philosophies discussed or presented on the show each involve their own unique risk factors, which are not discussed on the show. Any discussions among the panel participants or responses to listener inquiries are based on the personal opinions